Because I'm not anticipating as many questions. So let's go ahead and get through this. Remember we've been talking about exegetical rules. And remember, these are just rules that I made up. I had 9 of them. And so tonight we're going to talk a little bit about inferences. And then next week, I was asked to talk about some things that we do that are just aids to accomplish a commandment, and try to understand a little bit about the nature of aids and whether or not something is in fact an aid. And we'll be talking about things like having a tuning fork on the podium so that when we sing songs, we can sing at the right pitch, or something like that, or a song book, whether that's just an aid to help us to know all of the things that we're trying to do. So we'll talk about that next week, and then if there's no other questions, we'll probably start our new discussion, and we'll be talking about the fruit that we bear beginning the week after next. So I'll be sending out some information about that, and you can be thinking about that before we get started. Okay. Tonight we're going to talk a little bit about the idea of inference. Now, as you're looking at the material that I sent you, you should have the slides, but I'd like to go through kind of a bit of a discussion of the definition of inference. And it reminds us that one of the ways that we understand God's expectations is through reason. There are a lot of things that we learn because there is other information that suggests to us that we can draw a conclusion. And there's a difference between an implication and an inference. An implication is something that the speaker does. In this case, the speaker is God. So an implication is something that God does. God implies some information. And an inference is what we as listeners do. We take all of the information that we have, and we draw some conclusion from that information. I think God expects us to use our reason when we try to understand what He's given us. So, any questions about the idea of inference? That definition that you have on the handout that I gave you is a definition that comes from Webster's latest version of their online dictionary. And so that'll tell you where we got this definition. Any questions, any thoughts about difference between inference and implication? Okay. We're good to go. So, inference as a means of understanding what God wants us to know. Let's talk about kind of a couple of illustrations, and I think those two illustrations are very important. The first one is an inference that we draw from the information that we have that tells us how baptism was accomplished. So in Acts, the 8th chapter, you have Philip, who has joined himself to the chariot of the Ethiopian, and he's explained to him the meaning of Isaiah 53. And the Ethiopian turns to Philip and says, "Here's water. What hinders me to be baptized?" And Philip says, "If you believe, you can." Then at verse 38, it says, he commanded the chariot to stop, and they went down into the water, both Philip and the eunuch, and he baptized him. So from that reading, I think it's reasonable for us to draw the inference that there had to be enough water in that place for the two of them to go down into it. It doesn't say that there was that much water, but it just describes the activity, and so we can infer that there was that much water. I know in the case of John the Baptist, the gospel record says that John was baptizing in Enon on the Jordan because there was much water there. So that's something that we could conclude about John's baptism. It specifically tells us it takes a good deal of water in order to baptize. And from that, we know by the express statement that his baptism required much water. When we get to the baptism that Jesus is offering us, We're only going to know anything about the methodology of administering baptism if we reason from a statement in Acts 8 at verse 38. That's the only place that I know that the record gives us very much information about the method of administration. Two men went down into the water and he baptized him. So there was enough water for the two of them to be in that water. So that's a case of inference, and I think that's pretty straightforward. Now, a lot of people have also made the inference that if baptism is properly administered, both people have to go down into the water. And they would argue, for instance, that the baptistries that they're putting into a lot of buildings, even Church of Christ buildings, today and in the last, 10 years or so, are baptistries that are so narrow that the only person who goes down into the water is the person who is being baptized. The person who is baptizing them stands behind the wall of the baptistry, and he can then effect the baptism. And there are some people that would argue that that's not a reasonable methodology for accomplishing the baptism. And it's based on their understanding of how it was administered in the case of the Ethiopian. Now, I don't know, just me personally, I don't know that that causes me a lot of grief if one person baptizes somebody from outside of the water. But for the most part, if you're traveling down a wilderness road and you come to a river, you're not going to have the luxury of one person standing outside of the wall and baptizing the other person. You might if there was a dam or something like that, but from my perspective, I don't see any purpose in drawing that inference, that two people both have to be in the water in order to accomplish an appropriate baptism. Thoughts? Jerry, you looked like you had some question. Okay. And that makes a lot of sense. And that, I think that is a reasonable inference to draw looking at Acts 8:38. There's not much question about that. I'm reluctant to say that if you were baptized by somebody that was standing on the other side of the wall, that you weren't baptized. But that, you know, that's not something that we have to deal with, because when we baptize people, both of them are going down into the water. That's the way our baptistry is set up. And in fact, my grandson Dash was baptized while we were in Kentucky. He was baptized in a backyard pool. And so Jeff, his dad, and Dash were in the pool. And a lot of the other people that were there were also in the water. In every case of baptism that I personally have been involved in, I was in the water with the person that I was baptizing. That seems to me to be a reasonable inference. Okay. So now let's look at another illustration. That's the first one. That one's pretty straightforward. That one, to my mind, seems reasonably easy to understand. And then there's another illustration where we have to draw an inference. And that one comes from 1 Corinthians, the 11th chapter at verse 25. This is where the Apostle Paul is discussing the beginning of the Lord's Supper. And he talks about how Jesus at the Passover took the bread, how he handed it to the disciples, told the disciples to eat. Then there's this statement that's made in verse 25. He says, "This cup is the New Testament in my blood. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of me." So I have the fact we need to be participating in the cup. That's an inference that we have to draw. And that every time we do that, we ought to do it in remembrance of God, in remembrance of Jesus, and that it would be something that would be repeated multiple times. It wasn't something that was done once and it's over, because of the way he says, as oft as you do this, then do it in remembrance of me. Unlike baptism, where I think that's a one and done kind of activity, I think the Lord's Supper, not a one and done kind of activity like baptism, but it appears to me to be something that we do repeatedly, and every time we do it in remembrance of Jesus. So the idea that it's something we do repeatedly is an inference, but I think it's a reasonable inference to draw from the information that we have. I'm not talking about whether we ought to do it weekly. That I just don't think that's in this passage. What I want to see from this passage is the inference that we ought to do it repeatedly. Okay? And I think there's pretty good indication that it ought to be a weekly participation, particularly when you look at something like Acts, the 20th chapter, which is a description of Paul participating in the supper when he was in Troas and did it on the first day of the week. He'd been there for 7 days. He stayed there. He was in a hurry to get to Jerusalem. He was going to leave tomorrow, but he tarried there for 7 days. So the totality of the context there, in my mind, leads to an inference that you couldn't do it on Saturday. Paul was in a hurry, but he had to wait until after Sunday because that was the day that it was done. Couldn't do it on Friday, had to wait until Sunday. And so I think that's a reasonable inference to draw from the entirety of that context, everything that was happening there in Acts 20. So we have the inference that we have operated with, and it's a familiar inference to all of us, but it is an inference. We had to reason to get to that point. I can't point to a particular scripture that says, you must take the Lord's Supper every first day of the week. That's based on reason around all of the other information that we have. In this case, it's reason based on an example. In the first place, it was in the first instance, Acts 8, in the instance of baptism, I think it's reason based on a statement. And it's also in the context of an example, but it's reasoning based on either a statement or a commandment or an example. Inferences don't arise on their own. There has to be something that leads us to make that inference. Now, I cite this one because it's important for us to realize that sometimes there are multiple inferences that can be drawn from a single statement. And there are a lot of folks, and I've used them as an example frequently, there are a lot of folks who would draw the inference that because Jesus said, the cup is the New Testament in my blood, they infer that there's some importance to the idea of the cup, the single cup that we all drink from. And so they see they draw the inference that we ought to use one container to take the supper. And when you talk about metonymy, of course, they say, well, that's true, but the cup is not the blood. The cup is the New Testament in my blood. It's the blood, the fruit of the vine, that's in the cup. Yes, that is a representation by illustration. That fruit of the vine is the blood of Christ. It doesn't become his blood, but it represents his blood. And they would say the cup is taken as the New Testament. Now, I have not concluded that. Some people have. That's not a conclusion that I have reached. And the question is, how are we going to worship together? You concluded that there's importance to the cup, and I've concluded, based on reading the same information, that I don't see importance to the cup. That's not an easy question to answer. I have worshiped with people who saw importance to the cup, and in deference to them and their understanding, because I wanted us to be able to worship together, and they couldn't unless there was the cup that had significance. I let the cup have significance. So we used one container. Those are always kind of thorny questions to try to answer. Do I believe that they have improperly inferred? Well, not according to rules of logic. I can't say that. Not according to the rules of language. I can't say that. I don't agree with the inference that they have drawn. And that's why, as we started this whole discussion, we said it's important for everyone to interpret or to understand or to reason. In the case of tonight's discussion, it's important for everyone to reason for themselves. And there are some folks who would say that by using the prepackaged elements that we use to take the Lord's Supper, we have taken the idea of a single cup completely out of the picture. At least if you're using multiple cups that are filled from a single container in the beginning, where, you know, you might take a pitcher and pour into each one of those cups. And that probably is a pretty good illustration of what happened when Jesus was instituting the supper. He took his cup with his fruit of the vine in it, and he handed it to the disciples, and he said, "Divide this among yourselves." So I think what they did was, they poured from his cup into their cup. But there was still the idea, the notion of the one cup that you started with. And maybe we distort that when we use the individual servings. I don't know. I don't have a problem using the individual servings. But I know some folks do. They feel like that takes us one step further away from seeing the one cup. Thoughts? Anybody?
So when Jesus instituted the last supper, I don't see where everybody drank from that cup. Is that significant? Because I don't see that. I see them taking from their own cups. Don't see it as being one cup. I don't see why he couldn't have blessed all the cups that they were drinking from, because they wouldn't have been drinking from one cup when they were eating. They would have had their own cups.
Right. And he gave them his cup and said, "Divide this among yourselves." So they probably took it, and each one of them poured some into their own individual cups, rather than passing his cup around the table and everybody drank from his cup.
Okay.
That I tend to agree with you. That's the inference that I draw from this. Jerry? one giant vat of grape juice, and they filled a bunch of those individual containers from that one giant vat. Yeah, I see that. I see that. And that's kind of the conclusion that I have drawn. Because even if we use multiple containers, it's always filled from one jar of grape juice. And we distribute it among those individual containers. Just like one loaf. And he did use one loaf. And each one of them took a piece of that one loaf. He didn't say anything about the one loaf, although the Apostle Paul does say we are one bread. And so they would see some significance to the one loaf as well. And I bring this up just because we have to understand that different people can draw different reasonable inferences from the information that we have. Now, sometimes people draw an inference that the rules of logic don't support. And I understand that. And in that case, I have a reason to reject the conclusion that someone else has drawn. And in that case, I have a reason to say that's an unreasonable inference. In this case, I'm not sure that I have that reason to say it's unreasonable for even you to have reached that conclusion, but I can say it's not a conclusion that I reached. Okay, and one of the things that we have to remember anytime we're talking about inference is that inference never arises without a specific statement or commandment or example that we're looking at from which we're drawing some inference. So you can't have an inference that arises without the underlying information. So let me give you an example. We have a command to assemble, right? That's pretty clear. And in fact, that may be an inference in and of itself that's drawn from Hebrews 10 at verse 25. Don't forsake the assembling of yourselves together. And the clear inference is that there was an assembly. There's no question about that. So we have a commandment or a statement that we need to assemble. And people would say, well, you have to have a place to assemble, right? If I just said, we're going to assemble on Sunday afternoon, the first question people would ask is where? How are we going to be together? And that makes a lot of sense. So it's reasonable for us to say we built a big auditorium so we could assemble in that auditorium. I'm not sure that it's reasonable to say that's the only place where we could assemble. I think we're assembled tonight. Now, we're assembled on a virtual platform, but I think we're still assembled. And some people have drawn the conclusion that that's not an assembly, because typically, in the first century, they didn't have this kind of platform, and they would have had to get everybody together in a single place. And they probably used Solomon's porch That was the biggest public space that was in Jerusalem, and that's where anybody could assemble for a religious purpose, and nobody would have prevented that. So they probably used Solomon's porch. I think in some cases they assembled in people's houses. But it's reasonable to conclude that that nobody in Jerusalem owned a house that was big enough to hold 5,000 people, along with their children, if their children accompanied them. So you'd have had 7,000-8,000 people in a particular place. But I know in Corinth, they did assemble in a house that belonged to someone, probably a wealthy member of the congregation. And the way their houses were built, they were kind of in an arrangement. The rooms surrounded a court, central courtyard, and they probably assembled in that central courtyard. But not very many houses had the ability to have a central courtyard like that. I think that's probably why they assembled in an upper room in Acts 20, second story or third story, somehow above ground level, because a lot of people had shops on the ground level, and then their houses were above that, and that's where they would assemble. But again, I don't think anybody typically had a house that would hold 3,000 people. So, to say that they had to have some means of assembling together indicates first century it was probably Solomon's porch. That's what they used. I suppose they could have gathered in the Colosseum that the Romans had built. They could have gathered in some of the theaters. I have not been to Israel or the Middle East personally, but I've seen a lot of pictures of the theaters that they would build into hillsides. And I know Jesus brought a lot of people together on a hillside and was able to speak to them using natural amplification that would happen because of natural features. I think my conclusion, the conclusion that I draw, is that we have to have a way to be together. Not necessarily a place to be together. And in fact, sometimes the place isn't sufficiently related to the underlying thing that we're trying to accomplish. You could say we have to have a place to assemble, so let's assemble at Disneyland. Well, that's probably a bad idea because there's so many other things that are going on at Disneyland. That place doesn't lend itself to doing what we're trying to do, to share with one another. And as a guy who's gotten a little bit older and has trouble hearing in the auditorium, this place in this classroom and online, as we are tonight, lends itself to being able to share. I think it's hard to do that in the auditorium because, frankly, if I'm teaching, I have a really hard time hearing anything that's said in the back half of the auditorium. And so we do a lot of things to try to accomplish doing that. We build the auditorium in such a way that the acoustics lend themselves to sharing, and sometimes we hang microphones from the ceiling, like we have here. We have the microphone hanging from the ceiling. You could have somebody running around with a microphone, and if you were going to share information, they'd hand you the microphone so you could speak. And I've been at conferences where and convention centers where they did just exactly that. The speaker was on the stage and opened up the floor for questions and sharing, and so you had three or four people with microphones, and you'd raise your hand, they'd run up to you and give you the microphone so that you could share. So sometimes it's a matter of making sure that something that we infer is reasonable addresses the underlying commandment that we're trying to keep. Comments? You know, that's kind of one of the reasons that I don't think trying to have fellowship with one another when you have 300 people in a single room all eating together, that can be fellowship that you can have with one another, but it's really hard to do that, because you can't hear what's being said at another table, and if you make the tables too big, you can't even hear what's going on at the other end of the table that you're sitting at. That's kind of like, I'm sure you've been to restaurants for birthday parties or something like that, or some colleague is retiring and you go over to BJ's and you get that one big room on the side, and they put one big long table down through there, and one end of the table can't even communicate with the other end of the table. So I think even if I were to conclude that the commandment to have fellowship would indicate that we ought to do things together, still in terms of the inference, I think we have to be careful that what we're doing doesn't get in the way of keeping the commandment that we're trying to keep. So let's talk for just a minute about, we sometimes refer to necessary inference. And when we put the word necessary in front of inference, what we're saying is, you have to draw an inference, I understand that, but this is the only inference that you can draw. That there can't be another inference that could be drawn. And those kinds of cases are fairly rare in my experience. You know, we say, well, there's a necessary inference if we're going to be together, we have to have bathrooms. No, you don't. That's not the only inference that you could draw. The other inference might be, if you're going to come to this place, like my mom always said, go to the bathroom before you come into the auditorium. You know, and I, as a little boy, I was never allowed to get up and go to the bathroom. My mom always said, you go to the bathroom before you get there. That was her inference, and in my house, she wasn't God, but she was right up there next to him. So you had to listen to your mom. So we need to be careful when we talk about whether an inference is in fact necessary, because there really are very few inferences that you can draw that are the only inference that can be drawn. Even getting down to, well, why does the church have a bank account? We infer from the information in 1 Corinthians 16 that Paul said, you should lay by in store on the first day of the week, that there be no gatherings when I come, that they had taken up a collection of monies and they had to have a place to put it. So we know that we could have a place to keep the funds, and I suppose we could just stuff the funds in the bank, in the safe that's down here at the building, and keep all of the funds in the safe and distribute them from that location. So it's not a necessary inference to say that you need a bank account. It is an inference, and I think it's a reasonable one to draw. You need to have some place to store the funds. And it needs to be some place that's secure. I suppose we could just leave them in the collection plate on the front table and run the risk that somebody would steal it. Well, the inference that baptism requires a significant enough amount of water that two people could go down into it, I think that approaches being a necessary inference. That it's, I think it may be approaching the only inference that's logically supportable. And I don't think it has to be a statement that God or Jesus or the Spirit specifically makes. I think it can also be an example of the way that the apostles did the things that God told them to do. Or the early church doing the things that the apostles instructed them to do. We have to draw an inference about how the church goes about finding those people that are going to serve it from looking at the information in Acts, the fifth chapter. The early church had a problem. The Grecian widows were being neglected, and the apostles came together. They said to the church, look out from among yourselves seven men full of the Holy Spirit of good report that we may appoint over this matter. And so that's the way that they did it. And that seems, it seems reasonable to me to draw the inference that when the church needs to find servants, then we approach the church and say, look out from among yourselves these men. So even though it's not a statement or a commandment from Jesus or the apostles themselves, or Jesus or God himself, it is an example of the way that they did it in the first century, and it can serve for our learning. Other comments or thoughts? Well, thank you guys. Good comments and good thoughts. I hope this helps. You kind of clarify some things and you become a little bit more nuanced in your understanding of inferences, rather than just say, well, yeah, inferences are a way to understand God's will. We do have to be a bit more nuanced than that. So, like I said, next week we'll talk a little bit about aids and whether something is an aid or an addition. Is a piano to accompany the singing an aid, or is it an addition? Can it be defended as an aid? And we'll talk about, you know, using tuning forks. We can talk about the overhead projector, the projection system that we have that puts Bible passages up on the board so you can read it. Is that an aid or is that an addition? And we'll talk a little bit about that. And then if there are other questions about hermeneutics, by all means, let me know. And I'll try my very best to put together a discussion of those questions.